From PRX, this is the Moth Radio Hour. I'm Sarah Austin Jeunesse, producing director of The Moth, and I'll be your host this time. At The Moth, people tell true stories from their lives at bars, clubs, and theaters all around the country. They tell their stories without scripts or notes. In this hour, we have four stories for you. We'll hear from a Detroit-born journalist who realizes when he returns home that everything has changed. We'll hear two slam stories from a Russian boy finding his way, and our first story by Lauren Slater. Lauren is a psychologist and author who specializes in mental illness and women's health. She told her story in Boston, and the theme that night was Out on a Limb. Here's Lauren Slater, live at The Moth.
Starts off on a serious note. Actually, it's pretty serious the whole time. No, seriously, 4 years ago. All right, there's no way of doing this. Okay, 4 years ago, I was diagnosed with breast cancer. Okay, so you can't laugh about that. We all know, because we've all been blessed or cursed with frontal lobes, that we're gonna die. That's something that human beings all know about. But there's moments in your life when the plane goes bumpy, or you know, you're choking on a chicken wing, or where you get a diagnosis of breast cancer, when you realize with a real visceral intensity that your life is going to end, and that you're really no more than a series of seconds that are adding up pretty quickly. I also had one young child, 2 years old at the time, and I did not want to die. It's interesting because when you become a parent, your life is no longer the most important thing, which is a huge relief and probably a really good reason to have kids. But I didn't want to die before my child turned 18 years old, and I didn't die. The cancer was cured, so to speak, and life went on. After the diagnosis of breast cancer, speaking of Freud, actually, I had always heard that you can't die in your dreams, that that's a psychological impossibility. But after the diagnosis of and the treatment of the breast cancer, really and truly, I started to die in my dreams, and it was quite remarkable. And one dream that I had was that I was in a rocket ship, a small rocket ship. It was just about my size, and I was scrunched up in it, and I was speeding through space, going on and on and on and on and on, past the planets and out into the darkness, and I was awake in the dream, but I also realized in the dream that I was awake, but I was also dead, and that this was death. Death was speeding in a rocket ship through space, a kind of infinite insomnia. And then I woke up, and the day began, and then the next day, and the next day, and the next day, and the next day, and years went by. Our lives returned to normal. And my husband said to me one day, about 4 years later, my husband, by the way, is like a serious computer geek chemist. Like once he blew up our house with a series of test tubes, and his idea of nature is like, we live in Somerville, so that should say it all. But his idea of nature is like a waterfall on a screensaver. Okay, so he says to me, he says to me one day, I really want to move to Mendocino, California and become an organic farmer. And I said, you know, sweetie, you know, you can't even mow the lawn, okay? So what makes you think you can grow an organic tomato? And he said, no, this has been a long-term dream of mine. I said, I've never heard that dream before. He said, well, that's because we don't talk. And I said, well, that's because we had kids and blah, blah, blah. And he says, no, this really is something I want to do. And I thought he was going to forget about it, but he didn't forget about it. And he kept mentioning it over and over. And I actually started to become afraid that he was really going to take this, you know, do this, want to do this. And so I said, look, let's compromise. Let's buy land in southern New Hampshire, okay? And if you can mow the lawn and, you know, garden, you know, then we can then consider the larger move to Mendocino. And he said he thought it was a great idea. So we went, this was last year, we went up and we found a gorgeous 5.5-acre plot in southern New Hampshire. And we bought it and we were exhilarated. We were just exhilarated and we moved up there. Not permanently, but we moved up there for the summer with our kids. And I mean, the land was really gorgeous. There were two things about the land that worried me a little bit. And one was that we had, I mean, it was very rural, but the few neighbors that we did have all had names that were days of the week, like there was a Mr. Monday, and there was a girl named Sunday, and we lived near the Fridays. And I just thought that was kind of weird, but I didn't know what to make of it. And the other thing that worried me slightly about this place was there was a pond on it. My husband loved the pond. To me, at night, the pond had a strange kind of glow to it. But I would take my husband out to the pond at night and say, "You see that glow?" And he'd be like, "No, there's no glow." And so, whatever. It either glowed, it didn't glow, I don't know. But anyway, it was full summer. The land was verdant and lush and beautiful, and we lived up there. And towards the end of the summer, my dog's hair started to fall out. And I have two dogs, and their hair started to fall out. It wasn't shedding; it was falling out in clumps. And then my children started to get mysterious stomach ailments that would come and go. And one day I went to the edge of the land to remove some debris that had been left by the prior owners, and I cut my hand and I got an infection and went to the doctor. He gave me antibiotics, but it wouldn't respond to the antibiotics, and the infection kept getting worse and worse, and a red stripe was growing up my arm. Finally, the doctor gave me this really like broad spectrum bomb of an antibiotic, and it just blew everything away inside of me. And the infection went away. And it was as the infection was receding, and again, it's now getting towards fall, I was walking the land, and I felt something strange beneath my feet. And I went, for some reason, I just went and I got a hoe from the shed, and I to the land. And instead of dirt coming out, this insulation came out. I went to another place in the land, and I did it again, and instead of dirt, there was a sound of crashing, cracking, and it was glass. So I got my husband. I pulled at the land, and like it was like pulling at a couch, like stuffing just coming out, came out. So I got my husband, and we went to the edge of the land, and we pulled back the rug, kind of as though it was a carpet, and underneath there was trash everywhere. And meanwhile, the foliage is the growth is receding more and more, and we discovered that at the periphery of this 5.5 acres of gorgeous land that we had bought was what amounted to 10,000 tons of debris that had been hidden because of the growth. There were the carcasses of cars, there were car batteries, there were antifreeze bottles, there were torn mattresses, there were commodes, there were potty seats, there were, you name it was there. Beyond what you can imagine, it was everywhere. The state got involved and they came out and they said, this is an indiscriminate illegal dumping grounds that you have bought, and we're going to have to sue you for $1.5 million. And you need to, or you got to clean it up. So we called in several experts who came, and each expert came, and they said, well, it's going to cost about $1.5 million to clean this place up. Now my husband and I, at night, we're sitting around, our dream place turned into a nightmare for us, and we were arguing, you spent too much money buying furniture, well, why did you buy that tractor, well, it was your stupid idea to go to Mendocino, and that's what got us here to begin with, and our relationship turned very bitter. It was a very bitter time in our lives, one day we were out walking amongst the trash, which we did a fair amount, and we found we hadn't yet hired an expert to clean this place up because we didn't have $1.5 million and had no plans to get it soon. And we were walking amongst the trash and we found two tombstones. And at first, we thought they were part of the trash, like just tombstones that for some reason have been thrown into the trash. But I was like, you know, Ben, does, you know, can we move them? And we couldn't move them. We were tugging on. We realized they're anchored in the earth, that they were real tombstones. But there was no name on either of them. And it seemed to me that suddenly that those were tombstones that were waiting for us somehow. They somehow belonged to us. We, at that point, we got involved in litigation. And we went to see a lawyer, and he told us, well, the only way you're going to be able to get out of this is to, you know, start suing the people who sold you the land. So we instituted a terrible lawsuit. Lawsuits themselves should be outlawed. They're terrible. You know, it was, again, money. We were bleeding money. And I was on Craigslist one day, and I saw that someone was giving away an excavator for free. I was on Craigslist a lot those days on the free part of it because it just seemed like so awesome that anything could be free. And I thought, you know, why can't I just get that excavator myself and excavate all the land? Like, why do I have to hire an expert to excavate this place? It turned out that excavator was from like 1960 and it wasn't going to do the trick. But I said to my husband, let's get an excavator. And he was like, oh, that's such a good idea. And suddenly it's like we were totally connected and in love again. And a couple of weeks ago, we bought an excavator, a big excavator with a bucket on one side and a thing on another. And we are in the process of excavating the land ourselves. We told our lawyer that this was our solution, that we were going to do it ourselves. He says, a terrible idea. What are you going to do with all the trash once you excavate it? I had actually spoken with the man who dumped the trash there. I found out who it was. And I said, and his name was Harold Rideau, and he'd been dumping it there for 22 years. He used to own the land. Incidentally, the tombstones he claimed were there ahead of time, though. He didn't know who those belonged to. And I had gone to Harold, and I said, Harold, you have two choices. Either I can sue you, okay, or you can take this trash back. And he said, I'll take the trash back. So I said to our lawyer, well, we're just going to give the trash back to Harold. So lately, weekends, my husband and I and our two kids, who are in heaven, okay, I have a 2-year-old and a 6-year-old, we go up to New Hampshire and we get in the excavator and we bucketful by bucketful drive this huge hulking machine down to Harold's house and we dump the trash there. And slowly, slowly, okay, we are digging ourselves out of this $1.5 million mess. And we are suing, by the way, for the cost of the excavator, which is $15,000. And we haven't yet had the guts, the time, I don't know what, to get to the tombstones yet. I called the state about the tombstones. I said, do we need to, like, are we responsible for cleaning up the tombstones too? And they said, yeah. So we're responsible for exhuming those tombstones and haven't yet gotten to that yet. And we don't know what's going to be there when we do. Sometimes we think it's going to be a couple, one in one grave, one in the other, maybe two children, maybe just a poodle and a gerbil. I mean, I don't know what's going to be under there. But here's what I do know. When we dig up those graves, I'm going to get in one. I'm going to get 6 feet down, and I'm going to lie there. I'm going to lie there for a long time. I'm going to lie there until that rocket trip that I was taking in space in my dreams comes down to Earth, until the extraordinariness of death, that infinite, unbelievable trip that I was taking in my dreams, gets down to Earth and becomes banal. What I want to do is lie there, not until I get bored to death, but until I get bored of death. And then, when I've done that, I'm going to stand up and I'm going to start my life over and over and over again. Thank you.
That was Lauren Slater. Lauren is the author of several books, including The $60,000 Dog, My Life with Animals. I wrote to Lauren and asked if she exhumed the bodies by the tombstones and if she got down into one of those graves like she wanted to. Here she is reading her reply.
Yes, I did get down into the grave. We found the bones of what appeared to be a horse. I had always wanted to know what it would feel like to lie in a coffin, and had even considered having a woodworker make me one. Morbid, I know. So when we dug up the grave, and after we'd lifted the bony remains from it, I climbed down into it and lay there. The earth was packed and very cool, like a moist sponge at the back of my head, my arms pressed against my torso, my face tilted up so I could see the sky, salted with billions of dazzling stars, the moon a perfect crescent cutout. It felt wild and huge and awesome and overwhelming. It was one of those moments when you feel the sting of your own smallness, when you feel how fast and also how slowly the world works, and how you are just a speck spinning, and you go cold with fear, the feeling of falling, free falling, as the naked awareness dawns upon you that someday you will disappear, be buried down in the ground, your atoms seek being back into the dirt, or hurled heavenward to join all that astral matter. You realize that you are a category, a human being, but only for a very brief blip, and when you die, your category shifts, and you become a part of something so much bigger, it takes your breath away, and you could cry from knowing this. And then I climbed out of the grave, clambered out of the grave, and smacked my hands together, moist earth falling from them, feeling myself seep back into being a human again, the awesomeness of our ending receding, and banal concerns coming back, like whether or not there were any ticks on me. When you lie on the ground, or in the ground, in New Hampshire in the summer, you are likely to get ticks. And I said to Benjamin, check my back for ticks, and so he did, lifting my shirt, and with that single sweep of my clothes, I felt myself return to the regular.
That was Lauren Slater. Usually here I tell you to go to the website to see photos, but when I asked Lauren for them, she told me, we're not big on photos in this family. We don't even own any cameras. In a moment, we'll be back with two stories from one storyteller, Ivan Kureyev. In one, Ivan teaches himself English to impress his school crush. In another, Ivan's grandmother teaches him perhaps a more important lesson, how to stand up for himself.
Support for The Moth comes from Zillow. With millions of homes for sale, apartments for rent, photos, historical pricing data, and other resources. Available on Zillow.com or on their mobile and tablet apps. Zillow, find your way home. The Moth Radio Hour is produced by Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, and presented by PRX.
This is the Moth Radio Hour from PRX. I'm Sarah Austin Jeunesse. These next two stories were told at Moth Story Slams in New York City. We partner with public radio stations for these open mic competitions and have chapters all around the country. Anyone can put their name in a hat for a chance to tell a story. You can visit our website, themoth.org, to see if there's a story slam near you. You're about to hear two stories from the same person, Ivan Kureyev. This first story was told at a story slam-themed Romeos and Femme Fatales. Here's Ivan, live at the Moth.
Okay, so all I remember about Abby was that she had long brown hair, and that as soon as I saw her, I was totally and utterly in love with her. And what I remember best about her was that she wanted nothing to do with me. It was 1997, and I was 8 years old, and this was my first time in America. My English was really, really, really bad, and I studied some English and Russian in first grade, but we learned from these Soviet textbooks that were maybe from the 50s or 60s, and most of the lessons were something along the lines of, comrade, what time do you take tea? Or, could you please point out the way to the Red Square? So when I enrolled in second grade at Coralville Elementary School just outside of Iowa, these lessons were pretty useless. They were especially useless when it came to wooing Abby, because there are only so many times that I could ask her out to take tea with me, and there are only so many times that I could take to get rejected. So Abby ended up being my incentive to learn English. But I didn't want to waste time. You know, there are other guys out there, so I thought actions speak louder than words and gifts speak louder than actions. So every morning on my way to school, I would walk by her house and I would put a chocolate bar in her mailbox. And I did this for about a week, and I didn't leave any notes, but I was like, you know, chocolates, Russian boy, take tea with me, chocolates. She put the two and two together. She ignored me. She didn't do anything. So I found a confidant in Mrs. Brown, my second grade homeroom teacher, who was like the nicest Iowan woman in her mid-70s. And every 2 weeks, she'd give the second graders assigned seating. So one day, I approached her after class, and I was like, Mrs. Brown, I am in love with Abby, and you have got to put me next to her. So Mrs. Brown says, I'll see what I can do. And the next morning, I come into school, and oh my God, I'm seated next to Abby. And I'm thinking, this is my big break. My English has gotten better. This is going to be 2 weeks of like flirting and conversation and like the start of an endless romance. We get our worksheets, and Abby's all business. And we finish the worksheet, and she turns to her friends across the room and turns her back to me. And you know what? I'm kind of okay with that. Like, I'm kind of getting over Abby because my English is getting good. And I'm making friends with all the other second graders. And maybe I've accepted that things with Abby aren't going to work out. But then, in the late fall, we have an in-school field trip to the gym, to the school gym. Because there is a performance by a string quartet that's happening in the school gym for the second graders. So all the second graders file down to the gym, and we all sit in a semicircle around these string players, and we all sit, you know, cross-legged on the floor, and I make sure to pick a position that's right underneath the first violinist, but still really close to Abby. And then the string section starts playing, and it's this really moving piece, and I'm thinking, holy shit, this is it. This is the chance I've been waiting for. This is my big break, because if I just show Abby how sensitive I am, if I'm moved by this music, she will totally fall for me. And I'm looking up at the first violinist, and I'm trying so hard to force tears, and I'm trying so hard to force tears, and then the tears come, and then I'm crying, but then I'm weeping, and then I'm sobbing, and my body's shaking. I can't control the crying once I've started crying. And I'm sitting right under the first chair violinist, and you know, he's playing, and he's looking down at me. And it's only now that I look back at it, and I'm thinking, I must have made this guy's day. He is playing to this like group of 28-year-olds who are like picking their nose and like shuffling around and talking to their friends, and then there's this one who is looking up at him, cathartically sobbing. Whatever effect I may have had on the violinist, Abby was stone. She totally ignored me, and you know what? Second grade came and went, and so did Abby. But I wanted to commemorate that. I wanted to give her a goodbye letter. So in May, at the end of school, I sat down, and I wanted to do it with my voice. So I sat down with my mom's little tape recorder, and I put on this fake, like, 50s crooner voice. You know, like, when in the 50s songs, they have, like, the bridge, and then the guy drops his voice down an octave. So I sit down with my mom's tape recorder, and I say, Abby, I loved you, but you broke my heart, and now I'm going back to Russia, and I will never see you. Goodbye. And I spent, like, 2 hours getting this letter just right. And the experience proves to be so therapeutic that I don't need to give her the tape. And I lose track of the tape and I go back to Russia and I move on. And then like a year later, I come home from school in Russia. I come home from school to our apartment and I open the door and I hear the sound. And my heart sinks immediately because I immediately recognize the sound of my voice. And I walk to the living room and I walk into the living room and I see my parents hysterically laughing by the stereo. And out of the stereo speakers, I hear, Abby, I love you. But you broke my heart and I'm going back to Russia. Goodbye. And it's so loud, my parents don't even notice that I'm in the room and they're replaying the tape. And finally, my dad looks over at me and he looks at me and I look at him and he sees the betrayal in my eyes. And I look at him and I'm speechless and he's speechless and he just turns off the stereo and he's gathering himself and I'm like gathering for the kill and he looks at me and he just says, you know, your English was really good. Thank you.
That was Ivan Kureyev at a Moth Story Slam. Next up, another slam story from Ivan. This one was told at a night with the theme Day of Reckoning. Here's Ivan again, live at the Moth.
My grandmother was an orphan. She was born in Bashkiria, an area in central Russia, to a family of fundamental Muslims, and she lost both her parents by the age of 3, and she was raised by her older brother. And when she turned 16, her older brother sold her off into an arranged marriage, and he locked her up in a house with a man who paid to be her husband. And when that man came close enough to touch her, my grandmother pulled a knife to his throat and said, "You come any closer and I'll kill you." And she escaped through the window of that house, and she caught an overnight train to a tiny, tiny town called Oktyabrsk. And that's where she spent the rest of her life. I grew up in a Russian city called Saratov, and every summer I would leave the city to spend 3 months with my grandmother, and she gave me all the care that she never got from her family, and she spoiled me, and she coddled me, and she fed and fed and fed me, and she fed me dumplings and hand-rolled noodles and soup, and she baked me pies and roasted chicken, and she made me fried dough laced with honey, and she brought me cherries that were wrapped in newspaper. And by the time August arrived, I was so chubby. I was so fat that even she began to make fun of me. And she'd say, "Vanichka, you are so fat. You are so fat. Can you even see your penis from behind your stomach when you go to the bathroom?" And the rare days that I didn't spend eating with my grandmother, I played with the neighborhood boys, and all of them were older than me, and they were tougher than me, and they were stronger than me, and they were meaner than me, and I really didn't fit in with them. But I remember this one day, I was playing with these four other boys, and we spent the whole day building a fort. And we started really early in the morning, and we were building it until late in the day. And by the time it was done, its walls were so thick, and it was such a massive structure that it looked like it could withstand a hailstorm. And so we all filed in to celebrate inside the fort, and I was the last in line. And just as I was about to enter, the boy right in front of me turns around and looks at me, and he says, "You can't come in." And I said, "What do you mean I can't come in? I helped you build this." And he says, "You can't come in. You should turn around and you should leave." And so I turn around and I walk away. And I walk up the four flights of stairs to our apartment, and I tell my grandmother what happened, and I see her face overcome with fury, and I know that she's just as angry at me for not standing up for myself as she is at the boys who bullied me, and she says, "We're going to do something." And I get a little excited at the thought of revenge, and I say, "What are we going to do?" And she says, "You be quiet and wait." And so the whole night we waited, and we waited, and it got so late, and I was so tired. And finally, when it was pitch black outside, my grandmother goes to the kitchen, and I follow her to the kitchen, and I see her pick up the biggest kitchen knife and tuck it into the waistband of her dress. And I follow her out of the apartment and down the four flights of stairs, and when we come outside, it is so dark that all I can make out is the white shape of her dress and the knife that she's holding in her hand as she's running towards the fort. And I'm running after her, and I see her slip inside the fort, and then when I get closer, I hear the sound of breaking branches and snapping twigs and the sound of someone cutting through rope. And in the dark, I see this whole structure, the shadow of this mass, just collapse and cave in on itself. And my grandmother is still inside. She's doing this from the inside. And finally, she emerges, and she's laughing so hard. And she's laughing so hard. And she doesn't care about being stealthy now. She yells at me. She says, "Run!" And we turn around, and we bolt. We bolt toward the apartment building, and she's running with this enormous butcher's knife. And I'm running after her. And we run up the four flights of stairs. We run back into our apartment, and she slams the door, and she locks it behind her, and she heaves her body against the door. And we're both laughing, and when we're finally out of breath from laughing, we fall asleep in the living room. And I never found out if the boys actually suspected me. I never found out if they thought I was the perpetrator, because I spent the rest of that summer hiding in my grandmother's apartment. But I am sure as hell that they never suspected a 65-year-old woman who, in the middle of the night, picked up a knife and destroyed their fort. This fort that was built by a bunch of 12-year-old children that she tore down to avenge her grandson and to stand up for the family that she now had and to teach her grandson a lesson of how important it is to stand up for himself.
Ivan Kareyev lives in East Harlem and he works as a printmaker. I sat down to talk with Ivan about the tradition of storytelling in his life.
My mom and I and my dad, we had a very small family to begin with. And when we moved to the U.S. from Russia, telling stories became sort of a way of remembering where we came from, because there weren't a lot of people that we could, you know, easily share our history with in the U.S. That we had no family in the U.S. and we had very little family left in Russia, and we still do. And so when I went to college, I ended up going on these really long drives with my mom to Vermont, where I went to school, and we'd all of a sudden just mid-drive, we'd be sitting in silence, and one of us would start telling one of these stories about, and most of them were about my grandmother. And we both knew the story, and we told them to each other a lot of times, but, you know, we still kind of went through the paces of telling each other these stories. So I have a lot of stories just about my grandmother. You know, I think there are many days of reckoning when we were in her company.
For more of my interview with Ivan Kareyev, go to themoth.org. You can pitch us your story at themoth.org. Record it right on our site or call 877-799-MOTH. That's 877-799-6684. The best pitches are developed for Moth shows all around the country. Here's a pitch we liked.
My name is Rabbi Andrea Kiner, and my story that I'm pitching today is my first experience with a Ouija board. This occurred when I was at the age of 15. My parents were out, and I had to babysit my little sister, which was pretty boring. And so my friends, having mercy on me, came by, and Wendy brought a Ouija board, which I had never seen or heard of. She explained to us how it was meant to be used, and we sit down on the board, and we said, you know, is there a spirit on the board the whole way this thing goes? And the thing starts moving around. Are you pushing it? No. Are you pushing it? No. And it goes over to yes, and we say, what's your name? And it spells out Lucifer. Now, me being a nice Jewish girl from the suburbs, I'd never heard of Lucifer, and I had a quick education on who that was. And after a while, though, he admitted that he wasn't really Lucifer, that he really was Seth. And he told us quite a long story about his own life in Greece in the second century and so on. Really amazing, because we were transcribing each letter as he went through the whole story. And finally, we said, do you have any messages for anyone here? And it said yes, and then it spelled out my name. So I said, what's the message? And he said, Tile, stop, which we did not understand. And when we asked him to clarify, he said, Tammy, choke, which we did understand because my sister, who I was supposedly babysitting for, is named Tammy. And as the story evolves, we found out what the first part of the message was about. And I had some very good lessons that day about things being true and real, even if I have no explanation for them, and also some lessons about what's required to be a good older sister, because Tammy's life actually was in danger, and this word from the Ouija board alerted us in time, and we were able to save her life. So I think that's a pretty cool story. I thought it was cool when it happened, and that was a long time ago, and I'm in the rabbi business now, but that was kind of my first exposure to the mysterious. Thanks. Bye-bye.
To pitch your own story or to learn more about all of our programs, visit The Moth's website, themoth.org. All of the stories you've heard this hour are available at the iTunes store. Just search for The Best of The Moth. What happens when you come home and your only parent doesn't remember who you are? That story when we come back.
The Moth Radio Hour is produced by Atlantic Public Media and presented by the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org.
This is the Moth Radio Hour from PRX. I'm Sarah Austin Jeunesse from The Moth. Next up, our final story. We met this storyteller through one of our media partners, WDET in Detroit. The story you're about to hear was told at a Moth night called Past Tense, Future Perfect, Stories About Generations. Here's Charles Pugh live at The Moth.
It was 5 minutes to air, and I was so nervous that I could feel my heart just about to pop out of my chest. This was the biggest day of my life. I was back home, finally, after a 10-year journey at my hometown in Detroit. Thank you. Motown in the house. But I was about to go on television, finally, as a news reporter. So I was there, I was excited, thinking about who all was watching. There are 3 million viewers in the Detroit television market, 100, 200, 300,000 people about to watch me on television. But there was only one person who I cared would be watching, and that's my grandmother. So the story was about how to beat the heat. People had been passing out all over the city of Detroit. It was 100 degrees. So my job was to tell you how not to get heat stroke. So I nailed that first live report. I mean, I was great. So I could not wait to get to the news truck to get on the cell phone and call grandma and find out what she thought. So I called her. I said, "Hey, grandma." She said, "Hey, baby." I said, "What'd you think?" She said, "Of what?" I said, "You know, my live report. Didn't you just see it?" And she says, "Oh no, I forgot." So that cut me deep, because she was the only one I really wanted to be watching in that moment. I mean, this was the biggest day of my life. How could she forget? So the answer really didn't matter, so I didn't ask her why. I was so hurt, I just got off the phone and just wondered, how could she forget? She never forgot anything. She knew everybody's birthday. She knew everybody's wedding, everybody's anniversary. She knew all the baptisms. She wrote them down in the Bible. She knew all the family history and all the important dates. It was also doubly important because she was more than my grandmother. I mean, a lot of people only talk to their grandmother 3 times a year. But my grandmother raised me. She was more like my mom. When my mother died when I was 3, grandma just swooped right in and just, she rescued me, really. She took me off to Chicago for a few weeks as the chaos around my mother's death settled. And then again, 4 years later, when my dad died, there was Grandma Pugh again to rescue me. And she stepped up in a big way this time because she started raising me full time. She was 67 years old. Most people are retiring or already retired. But she took on the responsibility of raising full time a 7-year-old know-it-all. And she did it well. And it's interesting because she never forgot anything. She never forgot any of my school plays, any of my school functions in middle school or high school. I remember one time at a spelling bee, and I needed her so bad because I got out on the first word, delicious. D-E-L-I-C-O-U-S. Right. So I walked off the stage, dejected, head down, and I sat next to her. And as she always did, to come through for me. She said, "Hold your head up." She said, "You are my spelling bee champion, and I'm proud of you." And I did everything, really, to make Grandma proud. I got that scholarship to go to the nation's best journalism school, University of Missouri. Went off to school, graduated, got my journalism degree, all with the idea that I would come back home to Detroit to make her proud and be a television newscaster. And so my 10-year journey through all those small towns, Columbia, Missouri, Topeka, Kansas, Fort Wayne, Indiana, Norfolk, Virginia, all coming back home to Detroit. And she knew my goal, and she knew how important that day was to me. That's why I was so disappointed. And it was really interesting because as my career started to take off at home, I was interviewing the governor and the mayor and all these important people and really wanted her to be a part of that. It was like she was on a decline. The next time I went to see her, I walked in, the TV was on, but it wasn't the channel that I had just been on a few minutes before, so I knew she had not seen me again. And I went looking for her because she wasn't sitting in front of the TV, and she was up in the attic. And I said, well, Grandma, what are you doing? She says, "Oh, baby, I'm looking for the little white girl." And I'm thinking, well, this is inner city Detroit. And I'm like, "Grandma, ain't no white girls in this neighborhood." But I noticed that she really was looking for her. And it was heartbreaking to see this, my rock, the family matriarch, this proud woman who had been there for me in so many opportunities, so helpless in this moment. So I just grabbed her by the hand and I led her back to her room and noticed that the girl she was looking for was in the TV program she had been watching. She had gotten confused. So I realized then something was wrong. But the next time I went to see her was the worst. I said, "Hey, Grandma." And she said, "Hello, young man." And I said, "Grandma, it's me." And she said, it's nice to meet you." And it was in that one moment that I felt destroyed. I mean, my mom had died, my dad had died, and now my grandmother, who was my one connection to everything that mattered, was gone. And it was soon after that that she was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. And as my career was taken off, she was on a steady decline. About a week or so later, she fell, she hit her face, broke her hip, and we had to put her in the hospital. She was there for about 2 weeks, and it was during that stay that we realized that we could no longer take care of her ourselves as a family, and we would have to put her in a nursing home. So I rode with her in the ambulance from the hospital to the nursing home. And it was almost like God placed that ride through our old neighborhood to take me back down memory lane. And we went past the Motown Museum that my grandmother was so proud of. She says, "Baby, right in there. That's where all those teenagers, they walk in and they come out international superstars. Diana Ross, baby, Smokey Robinson, the Four Tops, all of them." She was so proud of that. And then we passed the church where she refused to join because she said the pastor looked like a crook. baby, we ain't joining this church. And then we passed the grocery store, where she would send me 3 or 4 times a week. I remember one time we were walking back from the grocery store and there was a downpour. We just got drenched. Her wig got wet, everything. Our food, our shoes were squishing by the time we got home, and she was pissed off and she fussed all the way home. But by the time we got home, we were laughing because you could only laugh that everything was wet. But that transition though for her, once we got her into the nursing home, was not easy for any of us, but particularly for her. And the people at the nursing home said that she was becoming increasingly violent, and that she would punch the caretakers. So when I would come in, they would warn me, you know, "Be careful, you might have to duck, she might hit you." So I went in to see her, and she was asleep. And I touched her. I said, "Hey, Grandma." And she looked at me. And she looked me right in my eyes. And she didn't say a word. She just started to stroke my hand. And it was almost like she was saying to me that I do know you. And I do love you. And everything is going to be okay. About a month later, Grandma earned her wings. She passed away on Christmas Day, 2003. And for most people, Christmas is supposed to be the best day of the year, but that was the worst day of my life. But somehow, since then, even though I'm still in many ways recovering from that, I realized that all was not lost, that she left me so much. All those amazing life lessons that she taught me over the years. She sat me down and I soaked it in. Those memories that I'm still laughing about. And that family history that is not lost, In fact, I believe that it will now live on in me. Thank you.
That was Charles Pugh. Charles is the president of the Detroit City Council. Charles told me about calling his grandma to tell her he'd won a journalism scholarship from Ford Motor Company. He said, "We both cried like babies. Grandma had a lot to offer, but no money, and she knew this was my ticket, and I was crying because I was able to make her proud." On our website, you'll see photographs of Charles and Grandma Pugh at his high school and college graduation ceremonies. That's themoth.org. Remember, you can pitch us your story at themoth.org. Record it right on our site or call 877-799-MOTH. That's 877-799-6684. The best pitches are developed for Moth shows all around the country. That's it for the Moth Radio Hour. We hope you'll join us next time. And that's the story from the Moth.
Your host this hour was Sarah Austin Jeunesse. Sarah directed the stories in this hour, along with Leah Tao. The rest of the Moth's directorial staff includes Catherine Burns, Sarah Haberman, Jennifer Hickson, and Meg Bowles. Production support from Whitney Jones. Moth stories are true as remembered and affirmed by the storytellers. Moth events are recorded by Argo Studios in New York City, supervised by Paul Ruest. Our theme music is by The Drift. Other music in this hour from Sigur Ross, Carla Kilstead and Matthias Bossi, Balkan Beatbox, Golden Ring Ensemble, and John Zorn. The Moth is produced for radio by me, Jay Allison, at Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, with help from Vicki Merrick. This hour was produced with funds from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the National Endowment for the Arts, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. The Moth Radio Hour is presented by the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org. For more about our podcast, for information on pitching your own story, and everything else, go to our website, themoth.org.